Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Creative Control. Comedy, art, and sometimes rock and roll. Let's do a public opinion poll. Raise your hand if you love creative control. 'Cause when Vish is unleashed, well, you... Oh, sorry, I didn't see you there. I was just working on a tribute song to my favorite podcast, Creative Control, with Vish Khanna. My name is Matthias, and I play in a band called The Burning Hell, but more importantly, I support Creative Control on Patreon, and I think you should too. Quality long-form arts journalism is like a magical talking unicorn. It definitely exists, but it can be really hard to find. Fortunately for us, Vish makes it easy with hundreds of funny, thought-provoking, well-researched, and engaging interviews with artists from all over the world. Your flexible monthly donation on Patreon will get you plenty of special exclusive treats and help Vish keep his podcast well-fed and cared for properly, the way a magical unicorn deserves.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Michael Feuerstack is a tremendously gifted musician, songwriter, singer, and producer based in Montreal, Quebec. A member of the Moncton, New Brunswick-based hardcore band Underdogs when he was a teen, in the late 1980s. Feuerstack and his family eventually moved to Ottawa, Ontario, where in the mid-1990s, he was active in the influential indie rock band The Wooden Stars, while also tending to a lovely solo project called Snail House, which released 9 wonderful records and toured the world extensively. Since retiring the Snail House name in 2012, Feuerstack has continued to craft clever, heartfelt, funny, romantic, and mysterious songs and albums, including his latest one. It's called Eternity Mongers. It's out on April 19th, 2024, via Forward Music Group, and it prompted Michael to return to this show to discuss the record's evocative title and its social, philosophical, and interpersonal lyrical themes. A discussion about the phrase, "It is what it is," and Michael's new song, "What Isn't What It Is," creating an artistic space to convey thoughts and ideas, plus Larry David's Curb Your Enthusiasm, making an album in a Nova Scotia shack with producer Charles Austin, and bringing a talented horn section and also guest vocalists into the mix, upcoming tour dates, and work with Land of Talk, Bell Orchestre, and the Luyas, celebrating Snail House, other future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network, with the support of listeners just like you, who follow and subscribe to this listener-supported and donor-driven podcast, spread the word about it, leave nice reviews and ratings on your favorite podcast platform. That actually helps the show gain some visibility. I was skeptical, but it seems to work. So if you have a moment, please leave a nice review and rating on your pod platform. And also, those of you who make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, which is the primary and most reliable way for podcasters like me to make a living. All amounts are welcome, but if you or someone you know might be like a generous, wealthy patron of the arts type person and want to leave a larger monthly donation, well, that would mean a lot. But again, all amounts are welcome, and you get different benefits at different tiers. You can learn more about it by checking out my Patreon, so I hope you'll do that. Plus, in-kind support from independent businesses like Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, respectively, in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 857 of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Michael Feuerstack, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Michael. How's it going?
Hi, Vish. Great to see you.
Nice to see you.
Great to hear you, I should say.
Yeah, we can't. Well, we can see each other, but the people can't see us, which is the way nobody it should be.
We can see each other, but nobody needs to know that.
I have this happen on the show all the time now. People, my guests and I sort of make visual illusions that no one can hear. And I say, hey, for those listening, Michael just set the eggs on fire. And they go, oh, right. Okay, I can kind of hear the sizzling now. You know what I mean? So, yeah. Anyway, it's nice to see you and hear you both. And I wish there was smell-o-vision, because it'd be nice to smell you, I think, as well. Where in the world are you today, Michael?
It would be impressive, I'm sure. I'm in Montreal, in my home, my newish home. I've moved about 6 months ago.
Nice.
Into a new place, and things are good. Yeah, I'm in my little studio where I do a lot of my work.
Nice.
And including talking to you right now, which certainly doesn't feel like work.
No, I'll see to it that it does at some point, I'm sure. No, it's lovely to have you back on the show after so much time, and congratulations on this new album with an interesting name that I might as well ask you about. The album is called Eternity Mongers, and I wondered what that, you know, as we go, I think we'll talk about some of the what I view as, or hear rather, as philosophical curiosities. And when I hear Eternity Mongers, it seems like a nice umbrella kind of catch-all for what's going on some level. But also, I know you're funny. I bet there's some funny, there's something to that. Eternity Mongers just sounds sort of funny to me. What is the origin of that title, if you might, if you don't mind me asking, during this interview about your work?
Of course. Yeah, I don't mind you asking that one. That doesn't cut too close. I would say actually that you pretty much hit the nail on the head. Like so much of the stuff I put out in the world, it's like, it's funny and it's also true, and it's it touches on social issues and personal issues and philosophical issues, and it's also a little bit wry and a bit stupid, a little bit archaic, a little bit futuristic. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Eternity Mongers, I guess, could be like preachers or advertising agencies or even singer-songwriters or the kind of like pseudo-spiritual element in our popular culture. And so I don't know, it's vague in a way that I really like it. As you say, it kind of serves as an umbrella for a lot of the ideas on the record in a way that's kind of poetic and a little bit irksome, I think, too. Like, it gets under the skin a little bit in a way that is fun.
Yeah, I would say that it sounds actually, it seems like time is on your mind generally. I hear temporality and time in that title. I also hear people trying to control the future, control our time, maybe. Is that in there? Mm-hmm.
I think if however many times you ask me, is that in there, is however many times I'll have to say yes.
Forever. It'll be an eternity of affirmation on some level.
You could like bring up all these little sub questions underneath this umbrella that we're talking about, and I would probably be like, that's in there too, you know.
Well, this is a testament to both my knowledge of the way you tend to work and my extreme proficiency at my job. I think.
Perfect. I guess we could just end this right now.
No. Yeah. But it's not about me. I just wonder because, you know, we're in a weird I don't mean to put too fine a point on it, but I think we're in a weird time. And I think I talk about this with my guests quite often, you know, like among other things in the last few years, as we've endured stuff together collectively, time is on our minds and time doesn't feel necessarily as much on our side anymore. It feels like, I don't know about you, Mike. I mean, we're both, I think you've got some years on me, but we're entering that phase of like, oh, I'm on the other end of life a little bit. I'm in the middle somewhere, and I may start thinking about stuff. And then the world is also saying, I don't think you got a lot of time left. I'm going to give you some viruses. I don't know if you've been outside. It's a little fucked up. And so we're all kind of like, huh, how much time do we have left? And should I just put off that project forever, or should I not just get to it? You know what I mean? Do you have those kinds of thoughts? Like, not urgency, just like, maybe we don't have as much time as I thought. Do you have any of that going on?
Yeah, of course. Totally. I mean, I'm like firmly in middle age at this point, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that the title reflects on all of that. And I like the fact that it's neither personal nor public or cultural, but it's all three kind of thing. So yeah. And in particular, how it relates to the kind of marketplace, which is the mongers part of the title.
Yes.
So, yeah, I'm getting a little off your question. But, yeah, I definitely feel that on a personal level. Yeah, and it would be disingenuous to suggest that that's not turning up in the lyrics and in the music.
I think you and I came we both came of age at a time when there was no internet and computers all the time. Remember when the computer was just at your house? That was it.
Yeah,
you had one computer in the whole house, and everyone used it.
I remember handwriting university essays.
Yes,
for submission. I mean, and you know, computers. I'm not so old that computers didn't exist, but it certainly wasn't uncommon to like recopy. You know, make an outline and then write your essay, and then have to recopy it before you submit it.
Well, and again, I don't mean to keep harping on the title specifically, but like we've had this reckoning for the last, I don't know, 5 years at least, maybe 10, of like, what are we doing with these things? Why are we always on our phones? You know, my wife, she says hello, by the way. Michelle says hello. My wife is on the New York Times app all the time now. Now, I used to have the New York Times app, and I used to look at it for the news. But now I say, what are you doing? She's like, oh, I'm playing Wordle. I'm playing Connection. I'm playing Spelling Bee. I'm like, oh, my God. They made a thing so that you're just on it all the time. They're stealing our time. They're stealing our time forever. And there's something, a reckoning, I think, a feeling of like all this stuff that it had a lot of potential to do good things. A lot of it is just stealing our time. And totally. I don't mean that, again, eternity mongers. I don't know if it's about technology per se. It could be, I think it's a very multifaceted title. But do you feel that a little bit? That it's not time thievery, but it's like that. It feels like everyone's just clamoring for our time all the time. And that, is that swimming around
definitely.
In there?
Yeah, definitely. Like, there's never been enough time. I think that's a theme that most people face at some point, whether they're like raising children or running a career or running a business or all of the above. I think a lot of people tend to have that feeling, and I think it's just intensifying.
Yeah. these songs are really lovely, and they get in my head a lot.
Thank you.
I've been just listening to the record over and over again. And again,
cool. That's great to hear.
Yeah, no, it's wonderful. I mean, you have this knack for hooks, and I hope we get into it a little bit. For those who aren't as familiar with Michael's work, your mind's made up. Like, that's just an earworm. I will tell you that right now. And there's lots of these things. Michael has a gift for this. I'm going to talk about you like you're not here now, Michael, to the people listening, but there might be people who aren't as familiar with your work. But again, the humor. We have decided as a culture that we're going to use this phrase, it is what it is, incessantly. Yeah. To the point where even my man Bob Dylan put it in a song in his most recent album, Rough and Rowdy Ways. It is what it is. And comedians have made fun of it. What the hell are we saying? It's the stupidest thing we've ever started saying, all of us. It is what it is. What does it mean? It's stupid. The first song on this album, What Isn't What It Is. It makes me laugh every time, and I don't exactly, but it's not delivered in a particularly like, ha-ha, it's like solemn almost. I don't mean to keep harping on titles, but I feel like there's some meaning in there. And in that phrase, what is, I sometimes forget how to say it. What isn't what it is? Where did that come from for you? What does that mean?
How do you think I feel when I have to try to fit all those words into a line of singing?
What isn't what it is? I'm just so used to saying or hearing it is what it is that for someone to twist it into what isn't what it is, it makes me laugh every time. But I'm also like, it's for some reason my brain like has trouble feeling like I'm saying it correctly. Anyway, I'm sorry.
No, I'm happy to hear that. I think it's great. And I obviously, you know, had some kind of like puzzly, you know, fun interaction with that phrase too, or I wouldn't have ended up making a song about it. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's just an absurd thing. It's not only do we say it all the time, but we say it to like come to a conclusion about whatever topic we're on. That's what we arrive at. That's not just something we say, it's actually we use it as an answer, which is insane.
Well, I had a colleague at one of my last workplaces that noticed that whenever there was a big issue, I would say some semblance of, well, it'll be fine. And invariably it was like we'd figure out. It wasn't that we'd see it is what it is weird because it seems a little like resigned.
I mean, it'll be fine. Yeah, I mean, it'll be fine is at least infused with some optimism. Even if it is a little bit tickish or like, you know, if it's not particularly thought out or not particularly meaningful, at least it is optimistic. It's pointing in a direction. It is what it is just saying, and we stop talking now.
Yeah, you're right. I never thought of it that way. I guess I viewed it is what it is as being something of an, well, it's accepting, but people are using it for everything. You know, horrors are going on around the world or in our neighborhoods, in our communities. And people just, you're right. Yeah, well, it is what it is.
Yeah.
So I don't know why this perked your interest. Just so people know, the verse here is invisible to the light until you open your eyes. It is what it is. But what isn't what it is? Sorry, that's my phrasing. That's not how the song goes. I'm not going to sing it. So that is a question. There are a lot of questions on this record, it seems to me. Were you in a particularly questioning or curious mode in this batch of songs?
I don't think so. I think that's always been my MO, but I think I'm just being more direct about it. You know, to write the kind of songs that, you know, really makes you think, or it asks more questions than it answers, you know, these kinds of stupid ways that we define things. But, and to me, that's been always been kind of the goal. And now I'm just literally like throwing questions into the songs in a way that seems to cut out the middleman, you know? And I mean, that song in particular, What Isn't What It Is, I realized when I was looking back at it that it's actually a really simple idea told in a kind of a roundabout, confusing way, which is a little bit my style too. But it's basically just about how it's about love and how love is a renewable resource and possibly the only actually renewable resource that's available to us. And so it's just kind of like a plea to like to be loving to people. And it just, but I mean, you know, you can't just say something like that without, it's hard to send a message like that so clearly. For whatever reason, and I think I just found some sort of wiggly roundabout way of making that suggestion. But the idea behind it is really clear, and now when I sing it, it seems extremely clear to me, and I'm happy that I have a song that says that.
Yeah, I appreciate what you're saying about love. Like, there are like 50 question marks in this song alone, and I guess as a tone setter, it makes...
Is that true?
Well, I'm exaggerating. Oh, okay. I'm exaggerating the number. Hang on, I'll do it right now.
I doubt there's even 50 words in the song.
No, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. There's 11, 12, 13. There's 13 question marks by my rough count here. I'm doing a skim.
Wow, I'm a really inquisitive guy.
What is the thing you live for? What is the resonant tone? What is it that makes the time roll? What is it that makes the slow motion go? So again, I don't mean to harp on philosophy or whatever, but there is a sort of like, what is the purpose? What gives you purpose? Were you having these thoughts yourself, or were you thinking of others who are wandering the world and maybe not asking these questions or something?
Again, I mean, not to be annoying, but I think it's both. You know, I was asking them of myself and of other people. But then, like I say, when I look back at the song, the answer to all of them is really clear, and it's like pretty satisfying. And maybe someday I'll make a song that's actually understandable.
But no, you, I think you answered it earlier. You're saying the answer to most of these questions is probably love.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I think so. Okay. And I mean, or at least that's one strong answer. And that's what I kind of get behind when I sing it now that I've made the song.
Do you suppose what is happening societally, if you will, socially, culturally, is inspiring this notion within you to get back to love? I feel like, I don't know, I don't recall a stupider, more fractured, dumb, divisive, shitty time in terms of the way we're all interacting with each other and caring for one another. Do you suppose that might have inspired you to think, like, what are we doing?
I think so, Okay. I do think so.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to elaborate on that.
You know, some songwriters end up in a position where responsibility is ascribed to them by their fans. They they end up doing a body of work, and then fans expect certain things from them. And, you know, some artists will wiggle out of this, you know, and others will be like, yeah, when they're writing, they're like, I got to think about my people here a little bit. I don't know if you think too much about your work as some sort of responsibility. I know you take it seriously. I know you're very thoughtful with it. But as an artist, do you feel like some semblance of like, I need to make sense of the world for people on some... Not, sorry, that's a horrible way of putting it. I'm sure you don't think this way, but do you...
Oh, yeah, I was just about to jump down your throat.
I'm just trying to say, like, do you feel this sense of like... I don't know. I mean, we all have a sense of social responsibility, whether it's living ethical lives or trying to be good in our communities, these sorts of things, in your community of songwriters maybe, or in your dynamic with listeners and a following. Do you have any sense of that? Like, Is that a better way of putting it? I don't mean to put too much of an onus on
you. I'm just razzing you.
Yeah.
I have an awareness of that for sure. Mostly I feel like my main responsibility is to make something. Well, there are two parts. I need to make something that is meaningful to me and has value and not be putting waste into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And the new angle, which is maybe more to your question, is to not put things into the world that just feed the bonfire of things that I don't want to encourage. So yeah, I want to make something that has value and worth in and of itself between me and the work itself, but also between the work and any potential audience.
Yeah.
And something that can't be misused, if it's going to be have any utility at all, that it can only be used for good.
As I mentioned, you have a real penchant for hooks. And I mentioned Your Mind's Made Up, which sounds quite, well, I don't know, it sounds sort of positive, but then when I think about it and what it means these days, well, we live in a world where certain people think a certain thing, and it doesn't matter what you say or what facts you present to them or whatever, their mind's made up. Like, they've decided who they are. But this song has this whimsy to it. But you also earlier said something about some of it maybe being derived from being irked by stuff. So I wonder, in that song? Let's talk about that song for a second. Your Mind's Made Up.
Sure, yeah.
Is that?
I mean, it's interesting because it'll be a bit of a left turn, because that song is actually about something unusually specific compared to my work usually. And it's a little bit off the topic of what you're talking about, but it has a lot to do with the age that I'm at and seeing a lot of my friends and loved ones with children who are leaving home. And it's more about that unconditional love and the role that those parents are being placed into, and just kind of imagining how that feels. It's just kind of a sweet little song that's about something kind of unusual in pop music. And so it's really about that.
So the mind being made up is the child's?
Yeah.
Yeah, to leave. That is something I'm already dealing with. And my kids are so young. They're only 12 and 9, but they're growing very quickly. And I don't know. I had this, I talked about this recently with someone else. I had this weird, sad vision of my son being gone. And my daughter the other day, actually, I was just talking to my wife about this morning. My daughter was like, can I just live here forever? And I said, oh.
And you're like, yes, please.
Well, I did. On the one hand, you're like, but on the other, yeah. I mean, I said, sure. Yeah. I mean, she's 9. She just doesn't, and like at the same time, she wants to go out, go to parties. She doesn't, it's not like she just likes hanging out at the house, but she just was like, do I have to leave? And I was like, no, you can stay. But I've had these visions, and it's, you're right. It's weird. You make these.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it was an exercise in empathy about how, feeling that unconditional love and also the weird way that it must be so confronting to when your children do leave, that empty nest syndrome and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And the relinquishing this sort of daily interaction with your loved ones and all that kind of stuff. But it also needs to happen. It's like part of nature, so.
Well, you talk about feeling.
But it's vague enough that it applies to lots of different topics, of course. But anyway, yeah.
Well, getting back to what we were talking about, people wondering about their purpose.
Yeah.
Empty nest syndrome is a weird, colloquialism for that.
Of course. On the flip side of it, the younger people in that equation are going to discover, to seek out their own purpose, whatever that might be. So it's like two sides to it.
It is weird because often your kids will leave and then you are on the cusp of retirement. So you're just like, okay, I worked really hard and I had these children and everything's done. And so, it is a weird, Yeah. Okay. I don't know. I'm landing on something here, and I don't. You're not there. Sorry. Just and for the record, Michael, so people understand, you yourself don't have children. You were thinking about your friends. Yeah. So that's an empathetic gesture in itself, and yeah, I feel like there's a lot of these sort of ideas swimming around here, and I pick up on some vague references to spirituality as well. Were you intrigued by these notions of who people worship, why they worship gods and whatnot? Was that something?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's suggested in the title of the record too.
Yes,
I think so. But it's something that I don't know how to talk about in conversation, or certainly not in any kind of formal sense. But I think that's what the songs are for, is for me to mull over those questions in a way that's interactive, you know?
Did you write these all in sort of one batch, or are some of these song ideas, lyric ideas, have they been swimming around for a while?
I think it's probably a bit of a combo pack.
Yeah.
Some of them began the previous record that I did, Harmonize the Moon. I had a whole bunch of songs written, and it was meant to be a band project, basically what Eternity Mongers turned out to be, with the similar personnel and similar ideas. But the pandemic happened, and then I ended up making Harmonize the Moon, which was a completely solitary recording process. And I ended up poaching a couple of the songs.
Okay.
For Harmonize the Moon. And then, yeah, so things got a little jumbled, but it's all stronger for it in the end, I think. So
I guess I wonder if I was alluding to some of the societal rhythms that might have influenced your thinking about people and whatnot. But what I'm trying to get to, I guess, by asking about the timeline, is whether you feel like this is a record that is specifically born of this, of the pandemic. I mean, not just the pandemic, but like the way it has been revealed we were all going to react to any kind of collective calamity. In general, do you think it's... do you feel like it's...
I think so.
Yeah.
I think in general, yeah. I think I've always had this kind of impulse to resist binary thinking and the sort of societal binaries that are foisted on us. And I think that's... just be getting stronger with the times. And so this record is like both more clear and more vague than some of my past work because of that sort of like wanting to, like, it's clearer what I want to say in some ways, but I also want it, I want it even more to be a little bit circuitous and like puzzling for people to absorb.
So that's interesting. Yeah. Given sort of maybe.
I mean, I don't know if I've thought about this as much as right now. I'm just kind of.
That's okay. Yeah.
Because you're asking me these questions, but
yeah, of course.
I do feel that feels kind of, you know, there's some truth to that for sure. Like,
no, and that,
I'm a little
that. No, that's fair. I guess. Yeah. I guess what I am landing on then, hearing you speak, is, as much as you've infused some of these songs with that curiosity and, I suppose, uncertainty, you yourself are feeling a bit more sure-footed about yourself and these songs. Like, this does not reflect your own, any kind of malaise you're going through, I don't think.
Or certainly not any more than anybody else in these times. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's almost a confidence you're feeling, actually. Like, oh, yeah, I know what I'm doing. And this is like, I don't, you're not as shaky as maybe some of the narrative characters or whatever in these pieces, I suppose.
Yeah, that's maybe true.
Okay. Okay. As we look to, I mentioned.
There are definitely some narrators on this record who definitely aren't me.
Yes.
And there are some that definitely are. And so, yeah, you have a point.
I don't want to harp on the spirituality aspects of it or whatever. I gather from your initial answer that maybe it's both something you'd have trouble articulating, and maybe also something that maybe is something is a bit personal for you. But I see this title, When Heaven Dies and Comes to Me, and I can't help but wonder about it. It's heaven, eternity. You know, we're talking about eternity mongers and whatnot. But in particular, can you tell me a little bit about this? Serpent in the sky, the ever-watching eye. Serpent in the sky. That's kind of scary, Mike. Michael, what's going on there?
Yeah. I guess I love, like, playing around with those kind of images, like the sort of vaguely Catholic things in a really fractured, kind of obtuse way. But I thought that title was actually really funny. I think that's something I wrote down in my, you know, in a notebook somewhere, in my phone notes or something. I just thought, there's like the sort of brazen cockiness of that statement, like, when heaven dies and comes to me, it's this kind of like, I don't know, this is a narrator with like the all-powerful narrator.
it's rather evocative and poetic,
I think that's really like where I ended up with it. I was like, it's evocative and poetic, and I'm toying with these images.
Yeah. I don't know what it means. If David Byrne is correct, heaven is a place. And if it dies and it comes to you, that's a whole place. I mean, that to me, it's interesting because I don't know that. Is that a thing? I don't know enough about religion. Is heaven capable of imploding? Is that a thing?
That's
a
good question.
Do we talk about that? I've never heard.
If it is, that's not what I wasn't writing about any particular knowledge about that.
Okay. Just curious what it might mean, because people rely, some people, not maybe you and me, mm-hmm. I don't know, but they think, I don't care what happens down here. I'm going to go up there and everything will be fine. Then you come along down the street. You know what could happen? It might die. you might be fucked either way. So I just thought it's funny, but I never thought of it. I just never heard this concept before. This just came to you in a sudden?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. I'd never heard of that before either. But I thought it was both funny and heavy, which is always such a fun combination to mess with, you know? And so that's what I did.
Is it a fine balancing act to delve into such sort of universal aspects of life and thinking and belief systems without coming across judgmental as an artist? Like, you know, you're talking about things you yourself maybe not have a full grounding of it, but they're conceptually something, you know, some things that we're all sort of you know, aware of. Are you ever like writing and you're like, I gotta dial this back, I sound like a jerk, or the narrator sounds like a jerk, you know what I mean?
Right. No, I mean, sometimes if your narrator's a jerk, you just have to let them be a jerk, you know? That's like the integrity of the thing itself is the dictator. You know, you always have the choice to like not release the thing, but you have to kind of follow where it goes. But I mean, I don't know. I mean, if anybody got a judgmental vibe from my work in general or any specific piece of my work, I think I'd be a little bit disappointed.
It doesn't seem like your vibe, by the way. But I think when you're a critical thinker and then you have an artistic expression, sometimes mm-hmm. they meet. And
yeah.
So even again, going back to the first song, everyone has just decided they're going to say it is what it is. Well, you come along and twist the phrase. That's a little bit of a satire of what we're all doing. Do you know what I'm saying? And on some level, satire is inherently judgmental. By the way,
that's a good point. I mean, yeah, and I would hate for somebody to all of a sudden feel self-conscious when they're expressing themselves because they use that phrase and now they know that I think it's absurd. I would hate for that to like get in the way of somebody expressing their ideas, you know.
Well, here's the thing. I don't know. Are you familiar?
But you got to say something in this life.
No, you do. I'm not. And I'm not suggesting. I mean, that's a weird thing right now. People are afraid to say things, right? Or express themselves at all. Yeah. I'm not saying you're doing nothing, anything nefarious or anything like that. I just think, mm-hmm. You know, I think of you as someone who blends earnestness and humor. And I think, like I say, critical analysis.
Yeah.
There is razzing in your music. You were razzing me earlier.
It's true.
Playful. So sometimes, as you know, on an off day, you might be riffing and it's not going well. Your group of friends is like, hey, just shut the fuck up. Yeah, you know.
I don't even know if it takes an off day, to be honest. Every second day, maybe.
If your penchant is to find the lightness and try to create levity, but sometimes you got to be a bit sharp.
Yeah.
It can be difficult. Hey, thanks for listening to Creative Control, as always. As you may have heard me mention, I recently lost my day job, and I've had a few conversations with people since who've said, you had a day job? I thought your podcast was your day job. When I explained why it hasn't been my day job to a friend, he suggested I should share some of this information with people like you listening right now. So, in short, unless they have some giant exclusive million-dollar contract, podcasters are not paid to make stuff by companies like Apple and Spotify. Podcasters do not make any money from streaming royalties. Ad revenue is dependent on a certain threshold of downloads each month, and even if your show is accessed 30,000 times a month, the income you get is actually really minimal. So podcasters like me usually make time in our lives to support our communities and our interests to make these shows, and our most reliable source of income for this work is, in fact, crowdfunding. In my case, it's my Patreon. So if you'd like to receive ad-free episodes earlier than everyone else, regular newsletters and blog posts, bonus audio content, and support my work, quite literally, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Here's a thing I'll ask you about, and I don't know if this will resonate. Are you familiar with this television program, Curb Your Enthusiasm? You ever seen that?
Of course.
Yeah. So I'm a fan of it, and as we're speaking, it's just about to wrap up its final season. And Larry David has kind of infamously been associated with this character that he's created, whose name is Larry David. And what Larry David, the real guy, says is, that's not me. That's like an id. That's just who I wish I could be in real life. Because for those who haven't seen the show, the fake Larry David tends to be a bit, he has rules about how people should live. And he's very judgmental in his own way. And he gets in absurd situations and conflicts as a result. But I often think about what it means, because in his recent press, he's actually kind of copping to it. What's happened is I created this character as a heightened version of me. And now, because the character is so well known, it's given me license to be a bit more like him somehow. Like, it's he created a monster, I guess, and now he's feeling like I can do that. People expect, they wouldn't be surprised if I'm like him. All I'm getting at is that's an interesting creative crossroads where in your songs, Michael, you can say things, because if someone would be like, you really think there's a serpent in the sky? No. That's the other Michael Feuerstack. You know, that's the character Michael Feuerstack. Yeah. I don't think that. Do you have that? Sorry, this was a very long wit. I just like talking about Curb Your Enthusiasm, and I'm using it as an excuse to talk about you. I'm just kidding. My point is, do you have that? Do you feel like you can express yourself in your music in a way that you may not be able to conversationally? Like, you can make these critiques or make these observations about how we're living in a more unfettered manner. Does that ever come to mind?
I think so. I mean, I think probably that's one of the reasons that I do it at all, you know, is to just like express something, you know, it's really that it's that simple. And even like making yourself understood in a conversation can be impossible sometimes. And there's a lot of like output in the culture right now. There's a lot of people talking and not a lot of people listening. And listening is something really good that you can do right now. And I think that I've been working toward being a better listener in general, and making a record is like allowing myself the license to a little bit of output.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, I think like, I mean, I don't think I'm in any danger of getting in any big trouble or anything with making such weird, obtuse, like poetic lyrics. But I mean, but yeah, definitely I'm expressing something that, I mean, certainly doesn't come up very often in conversation. And when it does, you know, it just all depends on who you're talking to. But this is really just saying something uninterrupted in a way that I can get behind.
Yeah.
And that's, I think there's value in that, you know.
Well, you have such lovely turns of phrase throughout your catalog, but yeah, this record, I don't know, like sometimes I think of you, I think, as a comedic writer. I think I've already expressed this. It's not to undermine anything. Sorry, I always feel badly quasi-apologizing when musicians are funny. It's good.
For me, humor is a big part. We've talked about this a couple of times when I've been on and in person, but like, for me, humor is not separate from other modes of expression. When I've made something that I'm really proud of, it usually has darkness, fear, humor, love, sensitivity, a drop of something harsh or brutal as well. Like all of those things have to coexist. And all the music that I love the most is like a slice of life, in the sense that it's like a cross section where you see a little bit of every aspect of life when you examine it. And to me, that's what I want to make when I make songs.
Yeah. I don't know what it is about me, but
so humor is by no means excluded from that.
No. And I will say your humor can be quite subtle. There's a song called Disenchantment on the new album. And I don't even know if you intended this to be funny, but I definitely think it's witty or whatever. There's a line here: if my deja vu is reliable. And I don't know what it means about what it says about me, but that just, it makes me, it warms my heart. Just this, it's just a nice little, I think, kind of funny.
Yeah.
if my deja vu is reliable, it's just a very funny and clever way of talking about memories. And, you know, as you get older, I think I've talked about this with people recently. Our memories are so, that we cherish, they start to flicker and they distort. Yeah. And you're like, did that even happen? Or something? You'll have lived with, I have this now. I live with something for a long time and I think it's one way, and I'll bring it up to someone who shared the experience with me. And they're like, no. That wasn't, I'm like, what? Are you sure? I've told this story like 50 times. They're like, no, it was this. And then you're like, oh yeah, you're right. It was a red shoe. It wasn't a blue shoe at all. I got that wrong. So anyway, I just want to say, for those who are listening, and I don't mean to gush too much, Michael, I just think you have a very beautiful way of just infusing, like this, that song, Disenchantment, it's not a funny arrangement. It's actually a very poignant, solemn almost arrangement. And then you've got these little jokes, I think. Sorry, do you view that as a funny line?
Yeah, totally. Okay. I mean, I got a kick out of it. I probably jotted it down in a notebook or something. And, you know, it's like, I want the music to come off as conversational. And I think that even when we're talking about heavy things, we often like drop little jokes into it, or we'll like give something big and then take it back with a little like self-deprecating twist or something like that. And I think that language belongs in songs too, or at least I like songs that have some of that. And so that just contributes to the conversational aspect.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. Speaking of...
It's very funny. I think it's funny, and I'm glad you pointed it out, because I think that line could just breeze by lots of people, and they just think, oh, that's sort of an odd thing to say.
Well, it's also like, deja vu is a feeling. It's not even a memory. It's just like, I think... Yeah. So if my deja vu is reliable, it works on so many levels for me, where I'm like, how can you question a feeling. Like, it's not really meant to be a memory. It's just like a feeling like you've experienced something before. I don't trust this feeling. Like, that's a whole other level of almost neuroses.
I love it.
Yeah, I love
Thanks,
it.
Thanks, Vish. Yeah. That's great. I love it.
I love it, too. Now, I want to ask, you mentioned conversations. I thought it might be a nice segue into talking about some of the people you worked with on this record.
Please.
Because the arrangements, you know, as someone who's followed your work for a long time, again, the album kicks off with What Isn't What It Is, which we've talked about a lot at my behest. I apologize. There are other great songs on this record. No offense, other songs. But that has a, I would say, like, oh yeah, this is a Michael Feuerstack record. Okay, no problem. Then The Path comes on, and it's got, I don't know how to describe it, but the horn section, the arrangement, even your vocal delivery, a little different. I mean, certainly different from the first song on the record, but also, I would say, catalog-wise, oh, a little looser. Some sort of groove is going on here. I'm sorry, this is now becoming a leading question. Can we talk about some of the people you worked with? Can you talk a little bit about where I'm getting at, how the dynamics of this record maybe are a little bit of a departure for you? I don't know if you feel the same. Let's talk about this. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly a departure from the last record, which was, you know, I wanted it to be like a communal experience. And I wasn't, you know, I don't have like the budget or the resources to necessarily always do things exactly the way I want, but I found a method that was really effective to make this record. And that was, I have these groupings of musicians. So I wanted to do it more or less live off the floor, which didn't prove to be really possible with my budget and time constraints and all of that stuff. But so we did the basic tracks live off the floor with the bass and drums and my guitar. And then my singing. And so that was all like within this. We'll talk about who the players are after.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that was like a very live snapshot. Like we had 3 or 4 days to do the whole album. And then I did the vocals really quickly and during those same sessions in one day. So just to retain some of that immediacy of playing in a room with people, which is, you don't hear on record that much anymore. Or at least, you know, if you do, it's kind of beaten to death, you know. Yeah. A lot of that energy is taken out of things with tuning and editing and all that kind of stuff, and so really consciously didn't want it to be like that. And so in order to retain that, I knew I wanted there to be the sax contributions as well. So in order to retain that sense, we did the two saxophones live side by side in really quick blast overdub sessions. Like they didn't pre-arrange anything. They came in, we recorded them live in the same room side by side, bleeding into each other's microphones. And then the same thing for the two backing singers. So,
yeah.
So just, you know, always with an interest to keeping that kind of live off the floor sensibility. And so the rhythm section was Kyle Kunjak and Mike Bellier, who are Snail House MF alumni over the years. And it was recorded by Charles Austin, who is just a peer who we've been leading parallel lives in some ways for, you know, 30 plus years. And I hadn't even really, I'd crossed his path once or twice, but I didn't really know Charles. But so I thought he would be,
oh, nice,
a great new addition. I always wanted to invite something new into the situation for each of these mini sessions.
For the record, Charles is one of my favorite people on the planet. And
he's so great.
Super talented and lovely. Yeah.
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 And he's like, he's so humble, but with so much knowledge and energy and goodwill. It's inspiring.
And funny.
He was
very, very funny.
It's so funny. Yeah. He's like a very lovable hoser. And it was really, he made it a lot of fun. And even though I can be really goofy and fun myself, I can also be a little bit too serious or take myself too seriously sometimes, especially in the studio, or if I get frustrated or something like that. And I think his energy was really fun to counteract that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a huge danger for us with that group of people anyway, but he definitely fit in nicely and kept pushing us in the right direction. And I love the sounds he got. And we did it at a shed, just there was a literal shed by the ocean in Nova Scotia for 3 or 4 days. And it was we had nice equipment, but there wasn't even a toilet in there. We peed in the bushes outside, and it was like, yeah, it was pretty punk ass in a good way. And then on the saxophone, we had Tim Crabtree from Paper Beat Scissors, who's someone who's played with me off and on over the years a lot, and is a good friend. And Karen Ng from Toronto, who's played with a multitude of people. Maybe you've even talked to her before. And if not,
Karen and I were briefly in a band together.
Oh, yeah. See, there you go.
Yeah.
She was the unknown quantity. You know, I wanted Tim in there because he knows me and my habits and my interests. And he's a good arranger and he interprets my ideas well, and he can make them come to life. And then Karen was someone who I didn't know that well, but I had crossed paths a lot of time, and I just, great vibe and an amazing player. So throwing them together was a really fun experiment. And you can feel that sort of getting to know each other on the record a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds lovely. And it does have that immediacy. So I appreciate you illuminating why that might be the case. It sounds like it was a conscious decision. Definitely. On your part. Arrangement-wise, did anything manifest itself in that sort of impulsive mode, or was everything pretty set for you when you brought everyone together?
No, definitely. It was pretty impulsive. Like with the core band, like with, sorry, not the core band, but the rhythm section, like Mike and Kyle, we had a few days before we went into the studio. We had a 4-day run where we just like hammered out how we wanted this, you know, if we wanted to have two times repeating the intro or one, or, you know, those kind of questions, and all like the little intricacies between the bass and drums were all determined. And I treated my guitar like an instrument in the band, as opposed to being a singer-songwriter where the band gets added on top of it. So
yeah,
we tried to arrange in a way where my guitar and the bass and drums were playing as an ensemble, you know, and not have it be adornment on a singer-songwriter record.
Yeah.
And so with the saxes, it was the same thing. Like, just we'd run down the track, and then they'd be like, okay, cool. And then I'd give them the chord chart if I had one. And sometimes I'd sing them a melody, and they were so great at really valuing that suggestion. Like, they would take that melody and just run with it and make an arrangement out of it. I might hum something, and they'd have the grace to like make it into something really wonderful and still letting me feel like it was my idea, which is a really generous artistic gift that I was given. And yeah, so, you know, and if they had their own ideas, they would run with them. But if they didn't, I might sing them a melody and they'd run with that. And it worked really quickly. We did it all in a day, all the sax overdubs.
So. And Karen and Tim came to Nova Scotia?
No, we did that in Montreal afterwards.
Oh, in Montreal, yeah. Okay.
That was a separate session.
Okay.
Karen came up to Montreal and stayed for a few days, and we just did it in one day.
Yeah. Nice. That's great.
And then the backing singers was a similar kind of process as with the sax singers. I invited them in without hearing too much in advance. I gave them lyric sheets, and we hammered it out on the spot, just in my little room in my house. And again, I think it was just one day.
Did you name the backup singers? I don't recall.
No. Oh, I mean, yeah. I thought you meant like, did I give,
Mike Feuerstack
and the majorettes?
No. Sorry. Did you cite who they were in this conversation? As you, did?
I was. Thank you for reminding me. I was just getting to that. Erika Angel and Laurel Sprengelmeier. So Erika is known for singing in Thus Owls, and has also just released an amazing new solo work on Constellation, and has been a on and off collaborator for only a short time, but I really love working with Erika. And Laurel is AKA Little Scream. People may know her work, and she's been singing with me off and on also for years. And we just have I have like a nice soul connection with each of those people, and I know that they feel the same about each other. And I just knew that if we put us all in a room together, it would be magic.
Yeah.
And it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I had them kind of almost act as if they were one instrument. So there are a lot of times when they're singing in unison, even, or, you know, sometimes there's like more elaborate parts, but the idea was that for them to almost never be singing independently of each other, to kind of act like it's like a single instrument. And they were really game for that and had, I think, had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, those additions, I suppose, give it a liveliness, the album as a whole. And I noticed with the backup singers, like, I appreciate that they're not perfect, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, they mm-hmm. have a bit of a, I don't want to say scrappiness is the wrong word, but it sounds mm-hmm. immediate. And well, there's, I appreciate that.
It's like the, you always get really great results when you take really great players and make them work quickly with unfamiliar material.
Yeah.
And as long as they're game and they're confident enough in how they carry themselves and what they put out when they're on the spot, it's like, it's just magic. And
no, it's a great yeah. call, because you're asking yeah. them, you're implicitly or explicitly saying, I trust your instincts.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go with your instincts and mm-hmm. don't overthink this. And I assume after the first couple of tunes, they really relax into that.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like they immediately they did. They're probably yeah. better at that than I am. You know, yeah. they're maybe some of the people I learned that from, you know, so.
Yeah.
And I just have to say, like, the whole process was like, I was in heaven the entire time making this record. It was like a really, it's just to, especially after the pandemic, and I had a little bit of funding to make the record. So I was able to hire people that I love and admire and spend time with them making a record, which is like, it's just the greatest.
Yeah. Yeah. There are lots of lovely arrangements on this album. I focused in on The Path because to me it seems a little anomalous on some level. And mm-hmm. I also, like, for those who haven't heard it, it features a rhythm section that are really in the pocket. And then I was thinking about these lyrics and I wondered if they were a little meta. There's not a single pocket deep enough to hold the groove of any one of us. And I wondered, I was like, because it's immediately what I thought when I heard the arrangement come in and the little horn stabs. Mm-hmm. Sorry, am I taking us down the wrong road? Is that a little, was that a little nod to that song as you were writing, or no?
Not really, no. But okay. It's cool. It's cool that that connection exists. I mean, I probably made that song strumming on an acoustic. Well, I know that I was like strumming on an acoustic guitar. I didn't know how the rhythm section was going to play out
yeah.
when I made the lyrics. But maybe that's them responding to that in the lyrics. You know, I mean, everything affects everything else when you're making these kind of creative decisions. So who knows?
Well, it is uniquely danceable. And yeah. again, maybe
we even have congas on that track.
That there's not a single pocket deep enough to hold the groove of any one of us. You can dance like no one cares. You can bang the drum, tapping out your rhythms until the daylight comes. Now, again, I feel like there's a whole other meaning there, and I'm being too literal about it, but that's what the song has, this sort of, I don't know what the groove is. I'm not smart enough, but mm-hmm. it has this. Would you agree it's a little different than other songs yeah. of yours? I mean, in terms of like just an approach rhythmically?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I mean, I know that I originally made a demo with there was a drum machine involved in the demo that I made, but it was a completely different beat and a different sensibility.
Yeah.
Which someday I'll probably make available on my Patreon page, which have not launched as yet, but I'll plug it now for next year or whenever.
Oh, okay.
Whenever I announce it. Anyway, yeah, there's a demo that I have a lot of affection for, but it's not, you know, it's not as good as the album version, but it's pretty interesting and pretty revealing. So I don't know. I don't know how to answer the question.
No, I'm obviously reading something into it that maybe you hadn't thought of.
But I mean, that's what it's for, is to be read into, you know, ideally. So.
Oh yeah. I don't feel castigated. Yeah. I don't feel wrong. I don't feel any of these things. I'm just saying, here's what I picked up on.
Well, then I'm not doing my job.
Well, I just that song, there's songs here that perk my ears as like, oh, Mike's trying different things.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But then, like, as I say, what is and what it is. Again, I have trouble mm-hmm. saying that. Your Mind's Made Up, Old Man Winter. Like, these are classic four stack joints that, you know, they've got the pop thing. They're smart. They're funny. They're clever. There's the heartfelt disenchantment. I don't mean to go through all the songs. I'm just saying some of it seems like, this feels like the guy I know. Yeah. And the kinds of songs he writes, beautiful, beautiful, heartfelt pop songs that get in my head. But every once in a while, there's like a bit of a left turn.
Yeah.
And I like that too. So I'm just saying, I appreciate this. Congratulations on this record.
Thank you.
Is there anything more you want to say about it that we didn't cover? I know we were a bit all over, or I was a bit all over the place, but anything more you want to convey about it before we wind down here?
No, I think, you know, yeah, I just, it was really, really fun to make, and I felt like a celebration, and so I'm really excited to share it. And yeah, the album art by Paul Henderson was just the perfect way to cap off the whole process too. So I'm really excited for the visuals and the music to like exist in the world at the same time.
For those who are listening, which is ideally everyone, hopefully no one's watching us somehow.
Oh yeah, I think you're going to see a big peak when people see my name on the list. It's going to spike.
No,
yeah.
I just mean, I hope no one's watching our conversation right now, like we're being surveilled. All I'm getting at is for the people listening, can you do me the clumsy favor of maybe describing the artwork that Paul did and why it speaks to you, why you said what you just said about its connection to the songs?
Yeah, sure. I think, well, Paul is a collage artist largely. I mean, he does lots of things, but one of his loves is collage, and the work for this particular record has everything we're talking about. It has a little bit of like spirituality, a little bit of anxiety, a little bit of absurdity and humor. And it's on this blast of kind of pinky purple background that I think, well, it's really pink, that I think is like also a nice left turn, in the same way the path is a left turn for the song styles.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The song, The Path, I should be more clear for the people. Yeah, it's just something that like intuitively just matched perfectly when Paul sent me it as an option. Hmm. And yeah.
Oh, that's lovely. I don't have a physical copy yet, but I can see it.
Neither do I. Actually, I haven't even seen the actual one yet. So
okay. Yeah, well, as Michael and I are speaking, no, the album's going to be out very soon. Actually, you should get your hands on a copy. Make
sure. Oh yeah, I mean it exists. I know that Kyle at Forward Music has them. I just haven't received it yet.
Okay, good. Well, I hope you. I mean, I'm glad they exist. And I hope you get one soon. A couple of things as we wrap up here, Michael, there. People want to learn more about you, where would you like to sort of direct them on the internet and to pick up a copy of your record?
Sure, yeah. Well, to get the record, there's forwardmusicgroup.com. There's my website, michaelfeuerstack.com. All of the usual social media things. If you search that unspellable name, you'll find me at all kinds of places, except for TikTok, which haven't yet adopted for whatever reason, probably because I'm aging out.
But there's just too many things.
Yeah,
I think there's just too many of them.
Yeah, but you can. Yeah, and Bandcamp obviously is a great place to find the music, either to listen or to purchase. Yeah. And the streaming sites are all representing my stuff as well. So
okay,
yeah. I don't think people will have a hard time if they're curious.
I'll link to some of the things you just said as well in the show notes, so people can click on those and be taken right into the universe of Michael Feuerstack. In terms of future plans, I wonder if you're working on new material. I wonder if you have tour dates, these sorts of things. Any of that in the offing?
There are sporadic tour dates. I'm doing some work with other groups for the near future, I'll do a launch show here in Montreal with a host of guest musicians and try to represent somewhat faithful versions of the album arrangements.
Mm-hmm.
That's May 26th at Ursa. And there will be more shows as the record kind of finds its way into people's hearts. I'll be continuing to tour, but there's no big tour to announce at this moment.
Okay. Sounds good. Did you want to talk about some of the other groups you're working with or no?
I can. Yeah.
Well, it might be a secret. Sometimes at this point, people are like, I got a thing. Can't tell you about it. I'm like, okay. What am I, chopped
liver? No,
there's
no secret. This week I'm leaving on tour for a month to play bass with Land of Talk.
Oh, lovely.
So that'll be keeping me occupied for the next bit. And I'm very excited about that. It's amazing music that I love with good friends. So mm-hmm. What more do you need? And
sorry to interrupt you there. How's Lizzie? Lizzie mm-hmm. was on the show for this mm-hmm. last record. We had a good chat, and then we talked. Mm-hmm. Actually, we talked a long time that day, beyond mm-hmm. what people heard. We spent the afternoon just catching up and talking. How's Lizzie doing?
Mm-hmm. Lizzie's good. You know, yeah. just managing. There's the making the tour happen has taken a lot of energy, but it's seems to be just about rolling.
Good.
later this week. And, yeah, playing music has been fun. It'll be fun to focus on that as the main thing day to day.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you talking about Bell Orquest, I think is what you're going to
say.
No,
it's all right. No, yeah. I'm just, yeah, Bell Orquest is slowly always working on new things, as well as the Luyas. And next year, 2025, is that next year?
Let's try that.
Yeah, we'll be, there are big plans afoot for, Snail House 30th anniversary.
Oh.
Something. Some kind of celebration. But 30 years just feels like, you know, I've breezed past some milestones, but this one just feels like it would be wrong to ignore it.
So, again, you were Snail House, and then you dropped the name and used your own name. Mm-hmm. Does it feel more...
But in a lot of ways, I sort of see it as this same project, you know? Like, it's...
Right.
Just because I changed the name... It's like a continuation. It's been a solo project all along.
Right. And okay.
I was at the helm of that, and I'm at the helm of me too. So
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, so the 30 years of Snail House, I don't know exactly what's going to happen, and there's nothing to officially announce yet, but something fun and unusual for me is going to happen.
Okay, cool. And by the way, I'm always happy to hear that you're at the helm of yourself. Not everyone has that luxury these days.
I'm driving the bus of Mike over here.
Well, that's lovely. Again, people can click on the links in the show notes, or if you heard what Michael said, you can click on those or find those and discover all this great music. Speaking of great music, Michael, I wonder if we can go out on a song from your new album, which as people are hearing this, will be out in just a matter of days. Is there a particular song that we can go out on? And if so, can you tell us why it came to mind?
Well, we talked so much about the path, and we talked about it being a departure, and you've made me start imagining it and tapping my foot over here. So let's let's do that one. I think it's a kind of a side door opening into the world of my music, and I think that could be fun for people.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that, and I would agree. From Eternity Mongers, by Michael Feuerstack. This is The Path. Michael, always a joy and a pleasure to speak with you. I appreciate you engaging with me and my somewhat convoluted questions and spending time with me. I hope it was enjoyable. And that
thank you, Vish. I really appreciate what you do, and I'm really honored to be invited on. So thank you for giving the space to my circuitous brain.
Oh, well, you're more than welcome, and I wish you the best of luck in the future.
Thank you.
You know I love to get it right, but I rarely do. Lost in the weeds, wondering what to do. Peeping through the dappled leaves at the crystal blue. While I'm alone in a patch of trees with a path worn through. Sit in a crowded parking lot and pray for things. To an angry god of your own imagining. I believe it when I see the lightning come. Every day is judgment day for everyone. Ooh. There's not a single wall that's big enough to collect the pain of any one of us. Tell me where I'm gonna be when I don't have you.
alone in a patch of trees with the path worn through.
Oh, what do I do?
A single pocket deep enough to hold the groove of any one of us.
You can dance like no one cares, you can bang the drum, tapping out your rhythm till the daylight comes.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Michael Feuerstack and also that music you just heard. I hope you enjoyed The Path and the other stuff you got to hear on this, the 857th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available just about wherever it is you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit vishkana.com. Also, please click on the hyperlinked text in the show notes that says follow Vish online to follow me online on social media and other things. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast going and to help provide me with a living. You've heard the messages, I think, by now, and I hope you have, if you haven't already, I hope you'll click on the link there that takes you to the Patreon so you can check out the benefits at the different pay tiers. I'm just constantly overwhelmed by all of the support of late, so means a lot. We're really doing well at the moment, but still not enough for me to not ponder, you know, getting a job or something. I got kids to feed and all that kind of stuff, but I love it. I'll be honest with you, this is great. I'm enjoying this, but I'm also, I got the worries, you know? Anyway, like everybody else. So if you want to support the show and check out all the different benefits how you can do that, again, click on the Patreon. It means a lot. Thank you so much for making time to even ponder this. I appreciate it. Thanks again to independent businesses like Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, respectively, in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. Also, thanks to Jim Guthrie for the music you hear on occasion on the show. You can learn more about Jim, and I hope you'll go to his website as well. He's got a great catalog of music there at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you so much for listening to this episode with Michael Feuerstack. His new album, Eternity Mongers, is out April 19th, so I hope this will prompt you to check it out. You know, listen to it. Tell your friends all about that. And also, I want to thank you for listening to this show, for subscribing to this podcast or following it, for leaving nice ratings and reviews on your pod platform, and for asking your friends or telling your friends about the show, you know, asking your friends to do the same. Check out the show, subscribe to the show, and help spread the word about it. It all means so much. So thank you very much. I will talk to you soon, I hope. I hope you're well. Bye for now.